Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Washington Huskies versus Michigan Wolverines. That is your national championship game. This is the College Football Fix presented by USA Today Sports. I'm Dan Wolkin with Paul Meyerberg. We're going to talk about it, what we saw, what we felt, what we experienced on New Year's Day, and preview what's going to happen next Monday in the national championship game in Houston. Paul, I think that as we wrap up the 14 playoff era, go to 12, just in time for the four-teamer to finally kind of come into its own here. I mean, the last couple of years, especially this year, the best set of semifinals we've ever seen. We're going to have a national champion that is not Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, somebody new, somebody fresh. I mean, this is kind of what it was supposed to be. Never really materialized until now, and we're already moving on to the 12 team. But that was about as good as it gets in terms of the drama, the stakes, the whole college footballness of the whole thing, don't you think?
Yeah, you had two semifinals end with the team trying to win. You know what I mean? Like Alabama trying to win in overtime or at least tie. Texas trying to win at the end of regulation. I just don't think you can ask for much more. And it's awesome that we got some uniqueness from the field, and I love the fact that this field delivered. I mean, really, really great. So yeah, good fitting end to the 14 playoff. I mean, this year and last have been what the format was supposed to be about in terms of the quality of games, and you know, we got it. So this is awesome.
It's rare in the sport that you can come into a situation like this and say, "Man, these two games should be awesome," and then they turn out to be as exciting or more exciting than you expected. Let's start with the Rose Bowl. Not the most well-played game from start to finish. I think we could all agree on that. I mean, there's just a lot of mistakes. Both sides, Michigan's special teams were a complete disaster. Alabama offensively for the first half was getting completely outcoached. I think that was the main problem for Alabama was Jesse Minter, the defensive coordinator for Michigan, was just kicking their ass with the things that they were doing pre-snap to confuse Jalen Milroe, the way they were bringing pressure, the way they were aligning. I think it just created a lot of chaos for Alabama that they just didn't get fixed in time. So from that standpoint, there were just a lot of mistakes. There were turnovers. Jalen Milroe had one in the second half that was particularly bad. Michigan comes down, does nothing with it. And then you get to the end of the game. And the second half, Paul, Michigan had, I think, 55 yards on 20 plays in the second half. And then it's fourth and two. And that's the ball game. 3 minutes left. They're going for it. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Blake Corum into the flat where there's just nobody over there. I mean, he's just so wide open. Like, I could have caught that ball and gotten a first down. And from there on, it was just like Michigan became this other entity, and they just dominated the next 3 minutes of regulation and overtime. And I just sort of left the field thinking, boy, the better team won. Michigan was the better team for the 60 minutes of that game plus. But boy, Alabama, that's one they normally finish under Nick Saban when they have a 7-point lead.
Yeah, and I guess the turning point to me, and again, I'm watching on television from New Orleans, the turning point to me was when Alabama had the ball 17-13 and they're driving with, what, 4.5, 4 minutes left.
Yeah.
to me, that's like you said, what Alabama does and has done, and like what they did against Georgia, they finish games. That's kind of been like the hallmark of Alabama. They don't play 58 minute games. So again, I thought the coaching was weird on the offensive side of the ball from Alabama. Certainly on that last drive, it got strange. They had a chance to put that game away. I think they were bailed out by a 52-yard field goal just to get into overtime, essentially.
Yeah.
So, interesting game. You know, it's funny. So, morning of the game, watching ESPN2, whatever. And it's an interesting question, though. You kind of know the answer. Who has the coaching edge, Alabama or Michigan? And the answer is obviously always Saban, because you could put whoever you want opposite Alabama, and the answer is going to be Saban. Like you said, a sloppy game, but I thought the Michigan coaching staff delivered. Like, offensively, they delivered in the clutch. Defensively, they delivered the entire time. Harbaugh had his pulse on the game, on the team. So you wrote a really good column afterwards that you should dig into more. But like you wrote, it's like a validating win, I think, for Michigan. Like a validating moment for the program to have this sort of win against that sort of team.
Yeah, I just thought the overall takeaway of it is Michigan passed the test. And it was a test for a lot of reasons, not just the opponent. You're talking about the greatest dynasty of the modern era. You're talking about the SEC, who they've struggled against. You're talking about Michigan in the Rose Bowl. I mean, look at the history of Michigan in the Rose Bowl. It's terrible.
Right.
Like, Bo Schembechler was like 2-8 in Rose Bowls or something like that. Harbaugh had been 0-6 in bowl games, right? So it's that test. It's, you know, can you stand up physically against that kind of just big physical NFL type team, which is just different than what you're seeing week in and week out in the Big Ten? They passed that test. They passed the making plays in the clutch test, which they won that one going away. They made all the plays in the clutch. So yeah. And then the sign stealing stuff, right, which has been the narrative around their team. So look, as far as I'm concerned, you can sort of put that to bed. It doesn't make it right what happened. It was wrong, and they're going to be punished, and they should be punished. But in terms of saying, well, this is why they won, or this is why they're such a good team, you can put that to rest. That came out. Connor Stallions is gone. They come out. They beat Penn State. They beat Ohio State. They beat Alabama. It's that narrative's over. They're legit, and they're going to the national championship game, and they're favored to win. We'll talk about who's going to win the game and what's going to happen toward the end of the podcast, but they're set up now to win a national championship, which, it's funny, when Harbaugh was hired by Michigan, I sent out a tweet that used to get thrown out in my face like every single year, which was something to the effect of, there's nothing more inevitable than Jim Harbaugh winning a national championship within the next 5 years at Michigan. Mm-hmm. Well, it may take him, what, nine? Is that right? Nine?
Eight.
Eight. It may take him eight, but it.
No, wait. Nine seasons. Right.
Yeah, it may take him nine, but it's got a great chance of happening. So, yeah, I just think this is a tip your cap moment to Michigan. And like you said, the coaching, I think, was the difference. I think Tommy Rees did a terrible job for Alabama. Every time Alabama lined up in an empty set, Michigan was able to basically get him on the ground.
Yeah.
And it took Alabama the entire first half to adjust and say, all right, we got to get rid of that formation because we're not blocking it. And really what happened is, I think Michigan was able to use the size of Alabama's offensive line, which is the biggest in the country and bigger than some NFL offensive lines. They were able to use that size against Alabama, and I thought did it very effectively in the first half.
What are your thoughts on the last play? What were your thoughts in the moment on the last play?
I think it was very similar to what had happened throughout the entire game, which is the snap issues really caused problems for Alabama and for Milroe. And I think everybody probably listening to this podcast watched the game and understands what I'm talking about, but I don't know. There were probably 20 snaps.
Yeah.
Maybe more that just were not good. That Jalen Milroe had to either, you know, bend down or go to the side or spend a second gathering the ball in. There was one that was on the ground and basically caused like a 20-yard loss. So the center quarterback issues were there all game. Frankly, they were there for much of the season. And on that last play, it was a bad snap, and Milroe, I think, kind of panicked and got out of what was called, which was like an RPO, and just kind of went straight ahead.
Yeah. It seems illogical that that would be the play call. Yeah, I mean, and I might be wrong, but I thought like maybe three or four plays earlier, Milroe had to like snatch one like a bullet, like over his right shoulder, like had to do. I'm holding my hands up like people are watching, but like had to like grab it sideways. So, yeah, real issue in terms of timing and all that stuff. Here's an interesting, to me, like trickle-down thought. J.J. McCarthy throws an interception on the game's first play. A, was that an interception to you? And B, like, it's just interesting for me to think about how different this game is if Alabama has the ball with 14 minutes and 53 minutes, seconds left in the first quarter, and they're already at the Michigan 31. You know what I mean? That's just really interesting play to me, an interesting moment. I mean, I couldn't have been alone thinking at that point of the game, and after Alabama kind of seemed in control for a moment after the McClellan touchdown, that, oh boy, like, I don't like the way this is shaping up for Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan was off to a real nervous start. I mean, I guess the interception call was right because it did seem like the defensive back there was out of bounds and left his feet from a position out of bounds to catch the ball. So I guess, you know, I'm not a rules expert, but I guess by rule that made him ineligible to get the interception. So, so I was fine with that. And ultimately, you know, ultimately Michigan punted, Alabama gets the ball, and they score the first points one way or the other. I don't think that was a huge impact on the game, but what I think it did do is maybe it settled Michigan a little bit. They were just nervous. I think they were tight. They were nervous to start McCarthy, you know, just a bad decision. And I don't think McCarthy was great in the game until the last series of regulation. And then and even then, like, he did fine, but it was really Blake Corum, you know, making the plays and then Roman Wilson making a play. I mean, these were not difficult plays. They were simple plays from a quarterback standpoint. Yeah. But
I think the point, Dan, is the point is, like, we've seen Michigan the last 2 years against Georgia and TCU be A, overwhelmed by the personnel, but then just overwhelmed by the moment. And they've gotten to a similar spot against TCU early, and they just didn't have what it took, even from a mental perspective, to get back into the game.
Yeah.
But this time, like, against Alabama, like, you just saw warning signs early, but their response to me just speaks so highly, just allows me to speak so highly of this group.
Yeah. You know? It was experience, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's being through those two games in the playoff and two different experiences, neither of them good, but coming back with an older team that was very purpose-driven this year. You know, I think that's the one thing that I will give Michigan a lot of credit for is just so much noise around their program, around Harbaugh, everything going on. It would have been easy for them to just get off track in one way or another, and they didn't do it. They just kept going. And I think that speaks well of them. And it'll be interesting to see if that carries into this week, where I think the big challenge for Michigan is going to be coming down off an extreme emotional high. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never seen a team celebrate a semifinal win like Michigan did. They celebrated like they won the national championship. And I understand why. I mean, just right. Everything we just talked about, going into this game, this result, to win it that way, yeah, totally get why the reaction was as emotional as it was. I asked Blake Corum in the locker room if that win compared emotionally to any of the, you know, the first Ohio State win or anything like that. He said, no, totally different level, just way above anything he had ever experienced before. So now they've got to go back, come down emotionally, get prepared for a very tough team. That's a challenge. I mean, this is, if you're talking about anybody else, I would say this is a hangover city type game coming up. But I don't know. Michigan just doesn't seem to be built, at least to this point, in a way where that kind of stuff matters to them.
Yeah. And not like, oh, whoa, it was Michigan, but they have been through a lot this season, you know, and they, I think maybe they've developed some scar tissue here that allows them to stay true. So interesting matchup. What are your thoughts on the Sugar? What were your thoughts? I mean, the problem with you is that, like, whenever you cover the first semis, the second semi can sometimes slip by. But what were your thoughts coming out of that game?
Yeah, it is difficult because the way it works is when you cover the first game, you know, you got to go down and spend some time in the locker room. Like, I was waiting to get into the locker room when Washington scored their first touchdown, right? So I was just like sort of following it on my phone. And then, yeah, then you get in. I couldn't really lock into it until, you know, midway through the third quarter, I would say, was when I could really sort of lock in on the game and watch it closely. Honestly, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I called it on the podcast last week, and I obviously did not pick the Michigan result correctly. I picked Alabama, but I did have, I think, a good finger on the pulse of what was going to happen in the Sugar Bowl, which is if Washington could protect Michael Penix, they were going to win the game because the matchup was just so overwhelming in their favor, their receivers versus Washington secondary. And I just thought Penix did a phenomenal job of, you know, avoiding the rush. I mean, he looked fast. He looked healthy. The arm was there. The accuracy was there. And it just didn't seem like Texas had much of a shot of stopping them.
Yeah, so I was there for Joe Burrow. I was there for Trevor Lawrence when they played Alabama. And I put Michael Penix right next to those two guys. In terms of a playoff performance by a quarterback, it was upper tier. And you are absolutely right. The hero of this game is Penix, right? Because he's got the stats. But really, this game was won by this offensive line. And people forgot. I even forgot. This was a Joe Moore winner, this line. Like, this is the best line in the country, according to a group of people who know offensive line play. And what they did against Texas in this defensive front, I mean, I think one tackle for loss, no sacks, clean pockets. After the game, talking to a couple of their linemen, they said that Texas was easily the best defensive line they've ever faced, like not this season, but ever in their entire college careers. And the way they stood up there is why I'm like kind of waffling, not to get ahead of myself, but why I'm waffling about how they're going to play against Michigan. Why I think it's not as easy as just to say Michigan's stronger and tougher. Because Texas was stronger and tougher than Washington, but they handled them up front. So I give credit in a couple of respects, not just for the line, but schematically. Kalen DeBoer had some interesting calls late, but by and large, I thought their run diagrams and schematics were strong. I thought unleashing Penix just three times as a traditional runner was brilliant, just to get those 31 yards and loosen things up. And obviously, that receiver core, Dan, is... I mean, Texas is not the Legion of Boom or whatever the Legion of Doom Seattle Seahawks group was, but I saw a stat afterwards that he targeted those top three guys, McMillan, Polk, and Adunze 20 times, and he went 19 of 20 on those attempts. So just an unbelievably elite matchup from a quarterback, receiver, and an offensive line. And overall, I think one of the best offensive performances, maybe not 19 LSU, but one of the best offensive performances by a team in playoff history. So I was impressed.
It's funny.
Really, really impressed.
Yeah, it's funny, Paul, because I was going back, I think like September, late September, mm-hmm. I sent a tweet that said, are we sure Washington isn't about to pull a 2019 LSU?
We talked about it.
Yeah.
I remember, and I thought about the same thing. Yeah, this was a 2019 LSU performance. It was skill talent. Line play, elite quarterback play, overcoming a talent disadvantage. LSU didn't have that, but in this case, overcoming a talent disadvantage and what was expected to be the biggest disadvantage, which was line against line. And Washington won that battle. They won that battle.
I would say that Washington's defense has not sort of developed the way that LSU's did that year. By the end, LSU's defense was pretty darn good that season. I think this Washington defense is overall just okay.
Yeah.
You know, now it might be good enough to win a national championship because of how awesome that offense is. But like there were some people in the media, you know, who were sort of breaking down that LSU comparison and saying, well, yeah, I mean, Washington, I mean, they don't really have that sort of talent, you know, the Jamar Chase and like, you know, maybe they actually might. I mean, when you look at those receivers and obviously Dylan Johnson, you know, I think is it's actually not that bad of a comparison with Clyde Edwards-Helaire. But I mean, I don't know if that receiving core is as good as LSU's was that year, but it's not that far off. It's pretty
confident. It's in the conversation, no doubt. Yeah, and I don't think any individual guy is as good as Chase was. But Dunze's pretty good. Like, he's really good. McMillan's good. Polk is pretty dang good. I mean, you're talking about three guys who'd have 1,000 yards if they were all healthy this season. So the comparison is not inapt to me. And like LSU, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they just go out and drop 35 points, 31 points on Michigan and win this game. So I don't think that Washington got the respect that they deserve. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that they had to fight and scratch and claw to win some games. But to me, if you're a football fan, a college football fan, and you had questions about Washington, I mean, the way that they played against Texas, it should answer all those questions. Like, this is not a team that is like TCU. Again, all due respect to Sonny Dykes and those guys, they're not backdooring into this game.
No.
They are not. Like, this is an elite team that would be worthy at 15-0 of being not just like the national champion, but a team that you talk about. Because they've played this way and beaten some good teams all season.
And honestly, people should have been onto that after they beat Oregon for the second time. Oregon is not some, you know, shrinking violet of a football team. Like, Oregon's a real football team. Physical, big, like NFL talent all over the place. Good on the line of scrimmage. Like, that should have told you that they were ready to play anybody. And I think they are going to be ready. Like, I don't think this is a physical mismatch against Michigan or that they're going to be overwhelmed. Do you?
No, I don't think so at all. And like, that's not to say that Michigan won't win that battle the way that Texas could not, or that Alabama wouldn't if they played, but you just can't. You cannot look at that game and as physical as they are from tackle to tackle on offense and think that they're going to get pushed around. It's just anything can happen, but you cannot expect that. You just can't. This line, they're not Alabama big damn, but these are some big, big, big guys who are experienced, that are strong at the point of attack. Like, you did not hear about Devondre Sweat in that game. You really didn't. And that's one hell of an achievement to do that. So they negated Texas's biggest advantage and then delivered where it counted, which was downfield. So a beautiful offensive game, not a beautiful offensive game plan late. I thought if they had lost this game, Kalen DeBoer, a lot of the shine would have been off that guy for the way that they handled things late. But by and large, I think it's a pretty brilliant performance from the offense.
Yeah, we got to talk about the end of the game because obviously it seems like it's over multiple times. And I think there were some things that you go back at the game management side of it that just did not look very good for Washington. I mean, they come out after the, after they get the fumble, which honestly, how that was not called a fumble on the field.
Oh my God.
I don't understand. Unreal. I don't understand.
Like, I was beside myself. I could not believe it that they had to reverse that.
When you saw the replay, like, that's the most obvious fumble I've ever seen. I mean, he's got the ball like almost at his shoulder, and he's fumbling it. And yeah. I was just like, I don't know. I don't know if the ref was just like screened from the play or something like that. But if that's the case, then you can't call him down. I don't know. It was very bizarre. So I'm glad they had the replay there to overturn that, because that would have just been robbery. And I know that Texas fans at the end of the day had some complaints with the officiating and felt like they didn't get a very good whistle, which maybe they didn't, but that was just so egregious that I can't believe it. So Washington gets that. And if they score on that possession, it's over. The game's definitely over, but they go three and out and run about 40 seconds off the clock. And you know, and at that point in the game, I do think that maybe you might want to, you might want to work the clock a little bit there. Right.
Yeah. And then I was in the, I mean, just being in the press box, it was like, you ever like try to watch someone parallel park really badly and you're looking around like, what is going on? Like, yeah. What are you trying to do? I was looking around at people next to us like, does anyone else understand that if they had run the ball here, that Texas would have gotten it back with like 13, 15 seconds instead of 40 something? Oh, like, does anyone else understand?
Well, that's even like two possessions later. So they go three and out after the fumble, and then the next possession, which they do get the ball, you know, they do advance the ball down and they got a, I believe they got a field goal, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They got a field goal out of it, but like you said, there was an opportunity for them to run it to make Texas use all their timeouts and they didn't do it. And, you know, I think when you don't get the touchdown, you're getting the field goal anyway, that's a problem. And then they get it one more time and, you know, and then it's like, okay, I understand a lot of teams aren't going to kneel the ball there, but literally, like if they weren't playing they weren't playing very aggressively anyway. So like just kneel it and you kick it or you kick up or you punt it. And literally Texas would have to go 80 yards in 10 seconds to win the game.
Yeah.
Instead, they hand off. Johnson gets hurt. That costs them the injury timeout. And Texas has what, 50 seconds to go down the field. They get a penalty on the punt. They give Texas 15 yards because he hit him early.
Stupidity.
Yeah, there was just a lot of brain cramps going on, I think, on the Washington sideline there, which if they get in position against Michigan to close out the game inside the final 5 minutes, like you have to just sort of hold on to your butt because Kalen DeBoer is just one of those guys who he's got such ice water in his veins. He'll make a great call, like going for fourth down from his own 30 against Washington State late in the game that ices it. But he'll do some unconventional things, and a lot of times they work, but I don't know. Like, if you're trying to grind out a Sugar Bowl, a semifinal, a national championship game, you may want to go a little more by the book.
Yeah, and look, I think that mentality is why they're 14-0. I think it's why, by and large, like, overall, why they beat Texas. But that's like it's very Leachian, you know, old Mike Leach. It's also it impacts the way they play. Like they play loose. They play fast.
True.
It's a reason why they led the country in penalties going into this game. They were 133 in penalty yards per game and then had, I think, 39 against Texas. So like that's the kind of Washington that can show up at any time. And yeah, like you said, I think Texas was a really good team. I just think it's different against Michigan. Michigan is a team that could suffocate you a little bit more than Texas could. So if you play that way and you get back to being a little bit less careful and you make silly, stupid mistakes, like with 50 seconds left or a 15-yard encroachment penalty on the Halo, that's going to lose you the national championship. So the ending to me was troubling. Like I wanted to leave that game saying, watch out, Michigan, but that kind of made me think, well, this team is not perfect. They're just really damn good. They will make mistakes, though.
Yeah, I do think it was interesting, like, the difference in the celebration. I wasn't there, so I didn't see it for myself. It seemed like the celebration was much less explosive than what we saw from Michigan. I think it was more what you come to expect from these semis, which is that you have, you have a minute to appreciate how awesome it is, but then you very, very quickly look at it and say, this is only step one.
No, it was definitely much more subdued. I mean, than Michigan, but Michigan was like a second coming of the Rose Bowl parade. It's what we kind of saw in the first couple years. I thought Michigan, like I thought a lot of teams celebrated that way early. And then they kind of got a cut from the fact that, hey, we've got to play another game. Washington was not, I mean, they're rocking the shirts and the hats and stuff, but yeah, they were not, they were much more businesslike, much more aware that there's one more game to play.
Yeah, I thought so too. But and I think that comes a little bit from DeBoer. I mean, he's interesting, and I think we're going to learn a lot more about him, you know, coming up this week. I mean, it's just it's just sort of amazing when you step back. This is a guy who, you know, was coaching NAIA ball not that long ago, you know, low level coordinator, you know, and then it's just been like a rocket ship. And just what, 2 years ago, Washington was in the Jimmy Lake era firing the coach because he was just a disaster. And I mean, this is in some ways like the TCU thing was crazy, just how quickly it turned on them, that they went from the end of Gary Patterson to Sonny Dykes and they're in the championship game. But that felt, I don't want to say fluky, but it was just like the stars aligned, everything was just perfect and everything went their way. This to me is just like Washington just hired an amazing coach who, yeah, and the personnel, I mean, the Penix transferring, he was with Ryan Grubb, like that was his guy. He ends up at Washington, that sets the stage. But Washington is the kind of program that you can get great talent. You know, there's talent in Seattle. They can recruit California. They got a great fan base. Like, Washington's a real program that can win national championships. And I just can't believe it's happened this fast.
Yeah. I just can't believe that a Pac-12 team can win the national championship.
After all of this, right?
Right. After all of this, a Pac-12 team could win the national championship. Are they going to show that game on Apple? Can I get a alternate stream on Apple TV?
it was amazing after the game when you saw some of the quotes. I was some of our colleagues quoting George Kliavkov after the game, and he's talking about, you know, oh, well, you know, if only our schools would have been more patient and all that stuff. I didn't sense a lot of accountability from him in terms of his role in the Pac-12's demise. I think it's a much longer and complicated story than even we can, you know, fully get into on this podcast. But like, yeah, it's a shame the Pac-12 is going away. But like, this thing was so far gone, and the unhappiness and dissatisfaction with what was happening in that league was so profound. I don't think you could have just saved it overnight. I don't think one good football season would have saved it. I don't think one team would have saved it. Like, I think there's going to be a little bit of that. I don't think that's really fair or a reflection of reality that, oh, if this had happened 2 years ago, that the Pac-12 would have been fine. I'm not sure that's the case.
No, I don't think so either. It's interesting to me, though, Dan, like, I don't even look at Washington as a Pac-12 team. I know that doesn't make any sense. I know it's a stupid thing to say. Of course they're a Pac-12 team. But it just feels like that is not a storyline that I'm interested in. Like, I just don't even really see that. You know, I mean, this is two future members of the Big Ten in a couple months.
Yeah.
So I'm not interested in this being a last moment for the Pac-12. The Pac-12 is dead, and they're dead. So, good night.
All right, what do we take away from the fact that there's no SEC team in the championship game? It's really, really pretty rare.
According to my inbox, it is either the end of the world or the greatest thing to ever happen, according to the fans that I've been hearing from, which is all cool. I mean, you have to be on either end of the extreme. I'm not going to make anything of it. Alabama, like you said, could very well be here. Georgia, when all is said and done, is probably the best team in the country. They lost one game. So I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, Dan. I think it's really good for the sport in general. I don't care about TV ratings or anything like that. I think it's cool to have these two unique teams that haven't been here before in the championship game. I'm all about that. But no, I don't think it says anything whatsoever about the current or future state of the SEC. It's still the best league in the country. It will continue to be the best league in the country.
All right, so we've heard a lot of this kind of conversation about, oh, well, Georgia is still the best team. You know, if they would have gotten in, they would have been the favorite. I guess my question is why? Like, why do we think that? They lost to Alabama and lost decisively.
Mm-hmm.
And as we saw, like, Alabama was very good. They certainly were good enough to win that semifinal. But this was not a historic, amazing Alabama team. I think if you were ranking Saban's, you know, 15 teams that he's had at Alabama, this one would be toward the bottom. It would certainly be in the lower half. certainly in the lower half. And Georgia couldn't handle them. So why do we think that Georgia would have been that much better against Washington? I'm not sure they would have been.
Because they beat Florida State by 60. Don't ask who Florida State played. I think Florida State played a couple PE teachers in the fourth quarter of that game, just local fans from the stadium. No, I mean, the truth is that it's easy to say Georgia's the best team in the country because we thought they were for 16 out of 17 weeks or 17 out of 18 weeks, whatever the math is, of this season. Everyone thought they were. So it's easy to say that. You can't say it because they're not here.
Yeah.
But just overall, like, to say that the SEC is down, or like the SEC, this is the beginning of the end. I mean, no one's really saying that. But to even like suggest that is just silly because Georgia is right there. And yes, Georgia could easily lose to Washington because they lost to Alabama, but they also could win. Like, I don't know what would have happened between Georgia and Michigan. It probably would have been a very, very, very good game. It probably would have ended potentially the same way, but Georgia's easily one of the top five teams in the country. So SEC's got two of them. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of overreaction on both sides to what happened in the Orange Bowl.
Yeah.
Georgia wins by 60. They had most of their players, and Florida State had almost none of their players. Like, what did you expect to happen?
Right.
Yeah, it was unfortunate, but at the end of the day, that both teams next year will be in the playoff, in a 12-team playoff. So I don't know. Like, when Kirby Smart and all these people are like, "Oh, you've got to fix this." Like, what is there to fix? I understand people are unhappy with the way bowl season is playing out now, and the opt outs and the transfer portal. Like, I just don't know what is actually going to fix this. I don't think paying players to play bowl games is going to fix it, because I don't think there's enough money in it. Like, if somebody is opting out or transferring, what is $25,000 going to make a huge difference for most of these guys? I don't think so. I mean, how much are these bowl games realistically going to pay? I just don't see it.
Let me do the math here. 25,000 times 24 times 20, 25,000. That's, and then per day, per, that's right. Major.
Get a
that's
calculator.
Good. That's good. Yeah, I'm using my phone to record this, so I can't. I'm trying to do it in my head. But I think that's a lot of money. So I do think $25,000 would be enough for a guy to play one more game. But no, I said this last week, kind of in jest. It's still kind of in jest. But the way to get people to play in these games and have them matter is to have a pile of money in the end zone, like in a Gatorade bucket. And then the winning team dumps each other with cash. And then everyone takes that cash home. Put $100,000 in a Gatorade bucket and give every player a $1,200.
All right, but the question is the cash edible?
It is. It is edible cash. Edible cash, and then you'll get – and then everyone gets one big check they can take to the bank, you know, and they get the cash, that thing. Look, Kirby Smart gets $175,000. Not Kirby Smart, but guys get $175,000 for winning the Citrus Bowl or something like that. Let's give guys a little bit of cash for winning the 68ventures.com bowl. You know?
Oh, I'm all for it. I just don't think that's gonna like make the bowl games important again. I think the bowl games are, as far as importance, the way or people taking them seriously or anything like that, it's over. Like, that's done.
Yeah.
It's just not gonna happen. Like, they're gonna still be bowl games. People are still gonna watch. People are still gonna buy tickets. Like, fine. But I just like don't know what people are so mad about. What do you expect this to be? And we've prioritized something different. Things change. We've prioritized the playoff. Okay. That's the sport now. Sorry. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, like you said about the Orange Bowl, like, that game fits whatever narrative you want it to fit. And we've seen it play out in real time in response. Whatever you want it to mean, you can make it mean something. I want to go back to one thing you said about Alabama. I am 100% agree, and I think even the Alabama fan base would agree that if you rank the 16 teams for Saban, this is like team 13. You know what I mean? Or team 14. You have his first year. You have the 20. By the way, Barrett Jones told me the 2010 team that went 10-3 was the best team he played on.
It was just dysfunctional.
Just dysfunctional, right.
Yeah.
So it might be team 15, in all honesty, or team 14. But I think this might be Saban's favorite team.
Okay.
I really do.
All right. Let's get into that for a second, because I think that's a bunch of crap.
Well, all what right. did he say afterwards? Were you in the press conference? He said something. He said something glowing about this team, and I should have brought it up.
No. He said, and just to paraphrase, he just said, you know, when you look at this team from where they came at the beginning of the season to where they ended up, it's one of the great seasons in Alabama history. Okay, which is a very sort of like that's the kind of thing like John Calipari says at Kentucky when they lose in the first round to St. Peter's, you know, to try to spin it. Look, I get why people say this is such a great coaching job by Saban. I understand that. But if you look at like the talent composite rankings and all that stuff, this was like the most talented team he ever had in terms of where the recruits were ranked, which is saying something. Like the number of top 5-star recruits that they had on this team was overwhelming. And I think my question would be, why do you need to do that great of a coaching job if you've got that much talent?
Right.
So I'm not on board with this. Oh, wow. It's such a great Alabama season. It was such a great Saban coaching job. Part of the job of being, in fact, as Nick Saban would tell you, the most important job of being a coach is the recruiting side, is the talent side. And I think you can look back at this team, serious questions about the quarterback position. I mean, Milroe is a physical beast and can do some incredible things, but like he's not a perfect quarterback by any stretch of the imagination. Offensive line underperformed. I don't know that this was such a great Nick Saban coaching job. It was a great coaching job against Georgia to beat Georgia for sure. But in the aggregate, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. I mean, you have a certain baseline when you have this talented a roster that you have to achieve. I guess it all comes down to those 2 weeks in September and then coming back to beat Georgia. It does represent at least maybe it's just something new for Saban, something different. So we're caught up on that. I was just struck by that comment. He doesn't do that. Like, it's not like Calipari, not that I know anything about college basketball, but it felt like he gets asked every single time they win, like clockwork. It's like Bob Holt. They parachute Bob Holt in to ask this question every single year. Like, where do you rank this team among your national champions? And he never wants to do it.
Well, he doesn't like comparing.
Doesn't like comparing, but like, I think if they had won it, he wouldn't have said this is his best team. I think he would have maybe admitted that this is the one that made him feel the best, strangely. The only good thing, I guess, is that he's now able to watch more foreign films on Netflix.
Yeah, that's
like this gives him another week to watch. I guess he's working through the Italian library. He might as well move to Milan at this point and just sip cappuccino and drive a Ferrari.
We're assuming he's going to come back, I guess. Like, there's been rumor and speculation he's not. I don't really buy that. But anytime you're talking about somebody who's in their 70s, it would not be a shock if he just one day woke up and said, I'm done. He's done enough. He's done enough. Yeah, he's made enough money. He's made enough money. It's just a matter of what he wants to do. You know, and I think Saban has evolved as he's gotten older. I don't want to say he's gotten softer, but I think he's gotten more introspective about some things, at least the way he presents it publicly. He's funnier. He's a little more warm and fuzzy.
A little bit, for sure.
A little bit.
Commercials have helped him in that respect. I think it's shown Affleck, people a little bit. Yeah, the Affleck stuff. I would like for him to start going by Nikola and wearing a scarf to press conferences. You know what I mean? All that. Yeah, I mean,
we'll see. We'll see where he goes on his vacation this year. Go ahead.
I just don't know if, like, 5 or 7 years ago, he's even admitting that he spends time watching Netflix. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
It's just he's just evolved. I don't want to say evolved.
He's humanized himself a little bit.
Yeah. I think he's let himself out there a little bit more, and I've enjoyed watching that. I do think he comes back, though. I do think there was also a week this past season where we asked each other if Saban was coming back, and I said no, and just felt like he wasn't going to be. I do think he comes back. The big question is he hasn't won a title in 4 years, so by next season, and we might as well at this point give the job to someone else.
Put him on the hot seat.
Look, Bill Belichick can get fired. I think Nick Saban can't get fired. It won't happen.
Do you think Jim Harbaugh's coming back after this game Monday night?
My bet on that would be no as well. I would just say no. If they win a national championship, it just feels like if he's got that itch, it's time for him to go scratch it again.
Yeah, the only reason he wouldn't go to the NFL at this point, I think, is just it takes two to tango. Somebody's got to offer him a job and make it financially worth his while.
And he's give him all the control.
And give him all the control. Right. So, and it's got to be the right situation. So, I just don't know how's he going to look at the Chargers or whoever. So
I don't know why I'm not hearing more about Washington. Washington, to me, with a new billionaire owner who seems only too happy to kind of get someone like that and let him run the ship, I don't know why that's not – doesn't seem more realistic. I understand why Harbaugh wouldn't want to go to Washington, but I am – this is not an NFL podcast, but I am – curious why that doesn't seem to be making more of a connection with people.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the jobs and what everybody's thinking with some of these jobs, but I just know that he's going to have to have an offer, you know, and I don't know that that's out there yet. He's got Don Yee hired as his agent. Don Yee's, you know, an NFL guy.
Yeah.
So I don't think you hire Don Yee to renegotiate a contract with Michigan.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. Kirk Herbstreit put out a tweet Tuesday saying that the national championship game should be at the Rose Bowl every year. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I love it. I love it. And I would be all for that. I wasn't going to bring this up. I am so sick and damn tired of the Superdome. I'm just sick and tired of games in that setting.
The Superdome kind of sucks.
It's a boring, stupid, ugly, dull, freezing cold. It doesn't get raucous. Maybe it does for Saints games. It doesn't for these games.
It does for Saints. Yeah.
Setting. Yeah. So I am so bored by games being played there. And I was watching the Rose Bowl and it was getting to that red horizon moment. And I was thinking, God dang it. Like, what an amazing, and you were there. What an amazing place to watch a game. And it is. And it is the seat of college football. College football's postseason. That is the big chair. I'm all for it. I would be all for that. I would love it.
They got happen. You with the sunset. They've
but I
captured
love that. Sunset's
you.
Incredible. That
it
sunset
is incredible.
Is incredible. I remember I and this ahead. Is who gives a shit, but I remember the first major no, that's not true. I did Alabama Notre Dame was the first title game I covered in person. But then the next year, Auburn, Florida State. I'd been there for, I think, Stanford, Michigan a couple days earlier, so it wasn't my first time at the game. But there was a moment in that game where I was like, I get it. And it was partly because of the red sun.
Yeah, I think I agree with Kirk that that's what would be right for college football. I think the problem with all of these stadiums – and I live in Atlanta, and we've got a great stadium in Atlanta. Mercedes-Benz Stadium is phenomenal. SoFi is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can look at all the stadiums where they've put the championship game. Indy, I think Vegas is going to – or no, Vegas is not going to have one. Because
Glendale was nice. I mean, these are Glendale, nice
places. It's, you know, these are great stadiums, right? But they're just sort of cookie-cutter – milquetoast pro stadiums. They don't have a lot of character. They're great in terms of amenities. Like if you're at the game, you know, nice concourses and good bathrooms and concession stands and all that stuff, right? Perfect. But they don't have any character. The Rose Bowl has character. It's got an aesthetic to it that says college football, that says this is important. It's unique. It's apart from anything the NFL has. The NFL used to play Super Bowls at the Rose Bowl,
yeah.
By the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think
into
there
the
was
90s.
Into the 90s. Yeah, there was a Cowboys 49ers. I think mm-hmm. that was the last one.
Cowboys Bills.
Rose Bowl. Cowboys Bills. Okay.
Yeah.
Cowboys Bills. Sorry. Couldn't have been Cowboys 49ers. But yeah, Cowboys Bills. And yeah, I think there are problems with the Rose Bowl. Like, it's old.
Hard to get to.
The parking flow and stuff like that is problematic. Like, the concessions aren't ideal. Maybe there's not enough luxury box space that they can make money. I don't care about all that. Mm-hmm. There is something special about it. People are – and I don't know. One person said, oh, this is just you sports writers being romantics.
Go to the game.
go to the game. I think even the fans get wrapped up in it.
Yeah, go to the game. And I'm not saying that as like, oh, like you're sitting in your mom's basement. Not at all. I really mean it. You don't think it's cool, and then but then go to the game, and you will think it's cool because it's a beautiful field, it's a beautiful backdrop, beautiful weather, and there's a lot of history. What else? That is what college football is. College football is history. You know what I mean? I understand the players and the coaches change. College football is history. Every matchup, every game is an onion. And at the center of that onion is the Rose Bowl. It is the seat of college football. So it's never going to happen. I was talking to a colleague about this at the Sugar Bowl, like what the future of the game is. It's always going to be at these, like you said, cookie cutter, big budget, football stadiums, NFL stadiums.
All right. They're going to try. They want to make it Super Bowl light. And that's right. That. And it's just, it doesn't really work for me, but that's how they're going to make the most money. But yeah, it should be at the Rose Bowl.
Yeah, like you're going to play a championship game in Indianapolis. Indianapolis, we should give away. We should give it to another. Like we should give it to France. Like here, Indianapolis.
Hey, come on, Indianapolis is fine.
No, it is not fine. It is bad. I'm not. I don't want to go there again. I don't enjoy it there. There's nothing redeeming about that place.
Oh my God,
Indianapolis is. I am not a fan. Nothing bad's ever happened to me there. Let's just be straight. Nothing bad has happened to me there, but I don't like going there, and I don't want to go there. And nothing about Indianapolis, nothing about the experience from the moment you land to the moment you leave tells you, yes, this is where we should decide the most important sporting event in my life this year.
Well, except for the fact that they serve a famous shrimp cocktail in the middle of a state that doesn't have salt water within 1,000 miles.
Yeah, that shrimp had to travel more than I did to get to that location. You know what I mean? So I'm not into that. You can make cocktails. If you want to make hot cocktail sauce at home, there's two ingredients. You don't need to go to Indianapolis. Buy ketchup and horseradish and add, here's the hit, man. Add extra horseradish. That's how you do it. So just take Indianapolis away. We can sell it. Here, you give me $50 and two nice bottles of Chateau Neuf de Pape, and we'll give it to France. Done.
The Rose Bowl is special. People who come out here to watch the game love it. To play the game, love it. Coach the game, they love it. Yeah, not going to happen, but it would be awesome. All right, let's talk about Monday night. What do we think is going to happen? Michigan is about a 4.5-point favorite. Look, I think my years of experience in this business just kind of tells me that this is kind of like the perfect way to wrap up this whole stupid Michigan storyline from this whole dumb season and the dumb controversies. And it's got that Kansas winning the NCAA championship 2 years ago feel to it. Mm-hmm. And they're just going to throw up the middle fingers at the world, walking off the stage with the trophy, because that's just kind of what happens. Right. And it just, I don't know. It just feels like that's the bookend that is going to happen this time too. But just from a football standpoint, like again, Michigan coming down off the emotional high, you've got to prepare for this ridiculous offense. And like Washington is going to throw a bunch of stuff at you. You're playing a better offensive line than you played against Alabama, I think, or at least an offensive line that is going to be more prepared to deal with what you've got. And you've got to deal with the best quarterback in the country who, frankly, should have won the Heisman, in my opinion. I just kind of feel like Washington's got this. But again, I flip a coin. I may feel different tomorrow.
Yeah, I can't, like I said before, I just don't believe that Michigan's going to push them around. I just don't think that. I just didn't see Texas do that. I don't think Michigan's going to push them around. I think schematically, coaching-wise, Texas is better prepared for this. They'll have less time to prepare, but they seem better equipped to handle Washington. But this is not going to be what people in some quarters thought Texas or thought the Sugar Bowl would be, which is a more physical team showing Washington what real football is like. That's just not going to happen. So, again, like the Sugar Bowl, the only factor that I care about is whether Washington can protect on third down. If they can and they don't give up a sack, yes, I do believe they win this game. And I don't know yet whether Michigan can do that. So
Well, the other thing, I
don't know what I'm going to say. Like, I don't know if I want to pick. I don't. I know I have to pick a team here. I just don't know what. Again, it just comes down to that simple factor. And I, you know what? I'm just going to say Michigan because I do think Michigan will do a better job just on the pass rush. So I do think Michigan wins this game, but it's not going to be a throttling. It's just I don't think Washington is going to allow that to happen or would allow that to happen as a team. I don't think it's possible.
Well, two things. One, after Alabama adjusted the protection in the second half of that game, there really wasn't that much of a pass rush. I mean, Milroe had, for the most part, had time to throw in the second half of that game. The other thing is Penix is just better than Milroe at avoiding the rush. Yeah. He's not nearly like the runner that Milroe is, but he's just got a better feel for where the pressure's coming from and his footwork to get away from the rush, to avoid being sacked, and then to get rid of the ball. Milroe holds the ball forever. Penix is going to get that thing out fast. So I just don't think that is likely to be as much of a factor in this game as it was in the Rose Bowl. But I also think like Washington's not going to be able to run. They're not going to be able to run it at all. And they may not even try.
They may not. And I think one difference between Washington and Alabama is that Washington has like a short to intermediate passing game.
Yeah.
Alabama like kind of does not.
No.
Like, it's kind of feast
or famine. Can't make those throws. Yeah.
Right. So, and Penix can make those throws. I think his delivery, his unique delivery, whatever you want to say about it, it is laser quick. And he can snap the ball out real quick. So you're right. I think they can scheme around. Even if Michigan does or is able to get pressure, I think they can do certain things that keep them off balance. I think they can score points on Michigan. I don't think that they are on defense built that way, though. Like, I don't think they're built as a defense to really keep Michigan from maybe doing what they want.
Right. Okay. But then the question becomes, if it turns into a game where Michigan's got to score a lot of points, can they be consistent enough? Can McCarthy be good enough to go score for score?
Yeah. I think that's a fear. That's a fear. Like a fear would be that Washington turns it into the Fiesta Bowl last year. And I don't mean that they embarrass Michigan, but they turn it into a game where you're going to need to do that. Like they basically, in other words, dictate what the flow of the game is going to be like and make your offense sweat. That's not a comfortable place for Michigan. Michigan, like their comfort zone is the second half of Penn State. We have the lead and we're just going to sit on you like a big brother and you're not going to do anything about it. That's their comfort zone. I think it's more likely they do that to Michigan than they do that to Washington, than Washington sets up this fast paced up and down game. But yeah, that is I think when I wrote the other day, like one of the three factors of the game is who sets the pace.
Yeah.
So the winning team is going to do that, right? Because Washington can't win Michigan's way, and I don't think Michigan can really win Washington's way.
All right, so I guess the ultimate answer is neither of us have a pick.
No, I'm just going to say Michigan. I'm going to say Michigan. I've had them number one for a long time.
You have.
I'm going to stick with it. I'm just going to stick with it and be Mr. Consistent and say Michigan.
All right, I'm going to be consistent and go with Washington, just because I kind of had that feeling from the beginning when the playoff bracket came out that if Washington got by Texas, that the week turnaround was going to really play in their favor from a preparation standpoint.
You did say that.
And that, you know, Michigan just has not seen a team like this. They really haven't. Michigan has seen a team like Alabama. That is an opponent in their comfort zone, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of style of play. This is, I think, a little bit out of their comfort zone, and I think Washington will just score enough points. So I guess that'll be my pick. But I can't wait to get to Houston. It'll be fun to watch going into a championship game with a new team.
Yep.
Winning it. It's been since 91 that Washington won a title. It's been since 97 that Michigan won half a title. I mean, honestly, Michigan.
And Washington shared, too. Don't forget. So
yeah.
Washington has never won an unshared national title. Michigan hasn't won an unshared national title since
before,
Truman administration.
Since before integration of college football. Which
I mean,
is
I was going to say that too, but yeah.
I look at college football history as pre-integration and post-integration.
Yeah, like, 1972-ish until now is a different era of college football.
I don't put any stock into anything that happened before you had black players play college football. Why would you?
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, things happened and people will claim the history, but I just think it's irrelevant. So Michigan is the winningest program of all time, but they're not a program that deals in national titles at this level.
I don't like that. I don't like them being called the winningest program of all time. At some point,
they're not in that group, right?
Yeah. Well, we also have to stop counting like Fielding Yost. Right. And I know I'm not like picking on Michigan. I think we do that way too much. I don't care that Princeton and Harvard didn't lose a game in the 1900s. You know that Washington didn't lose a game for, I think, the entire 1920s under gloomy Gus Dobie? Like, I don't care about that. That's a true story and a true name. They didn't lose a game for like 9 years in a row. I don't care about that. I want to know what has happened lately. And the truth is that, to go back to your original point, this is cool because neither one of these teams has won a national title without an asterisk in the real, quote-unquote, true history of modern college football. So this is an interesting, cool way to end the 14 playoff.
All right, let's end it right there. Should be awesome. Hope everybody enjoys the week and all of our coverage at USA Today Sports. Just keep reading. It's been great so far. We got a few more days to go. So for Eric Smith, our college sports editor, for Paul Meyerberg, I'm Dan Wolkin. This has been the College Football Fix. We'll be back to break everything down after the national championship game. Until then, enjoy it. Hope everybody has a fun time Monday night. We'll see you from Houston.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.